Reverend, let's again turn to Matthew and chapter 19. I did need to just make one small announcement, which was supposed to have been done by the Syrian Society themselves, and it's the fact that there's a little booklet. Have you got it available, Raymond? The one on Paul Kasonga? Okay, all right. No, then there's no need to make that announcement. I was going to make. Okay, so Matthew and chapter 19. Matthew 19, we will once again read this section. Now when Jesus had finished these sayings, that's verse 1, he went away from Galilee and entered the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. And Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" He answered, Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother, and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and send her away?" He said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I said to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery." The disciples said to him, "If such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "Not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. For they are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and they are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and they are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive, receive it." Well, brethren, we've made our way through two sessions. First of all, we dealt with the subject of marriage itself, and I want to repeat what I've said at the very beginning, that really this seminar is about marriage. The fact that we're dealing with divorce and remarriage, we're still really dealing with marriage. And ultimately, we must not attempt to change its definition, because the moment we start reinventing marriage, we're actually destroying it altogether. Because marriage doesn't have doors to it. Once you are in, you shut the door, you are basically in for life. That's the way you are to think. It's not like a job where you can think, well, if I'm not promoted, I'll get another job and so on and keep moving on. It's God's gift. It's the best gift that he has given to us, and indeed we ought to rejoice in it. However, we went on to see in the second session the fact that divorces come in, or the whole subject of separating, primarily because of the stress and tensions that come in. First of all, simply because we are man and wife, rather man and woman, coming to tie our legs together. We tend to think differently. We have different perspectives, and that tends in itself to be a source of stress. But on the other hand also, it is the fact that since marriage was created, sin has entered into the world. And because sin has entered in the world, we have become self-centered and selfish. And as we become self-centered and selfish, we tend to pull into opposite directions. And that's also what tends to cause the stress. What we have, however, seen as we've made our way through the subject of divorce is the fact that it still should not modify our thinking of marriage. It is something we, as it were, throw up our arms in despair about rather than simply add it to the definition. We saw that it is caused by sin, invariably, either because the two individuals themselves are stubbornly continuing in sin, or at least one. You never, and I'm still waiting to see that situation, where there's no sin involved, no stubborn sin, and yet two individuals are still speaking in terms of going their separate ways. So there is sin, it is stubborn, and in the process somebody despairs and heads out to the divorce courts. We saw the only situations that the scriptures allow for that. Well, inevitably, the next question that arises is that of remarriage. Is remarriage permissible? Our text puts it this way, verse 9. And I said to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. It seems to be fairly clear from this text that the Lord provides one exception. And the exception that he provides, where remarriage is not committing adultery, it is where there has been stubborn sexual sin on the part of one of the two parties. Let's read it again. And I said to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. So we'll just move the exception clause to the end so that we can see what it is really saying. It's not changing anything, but it just becomes clearer. And I said to you, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, except for sexual immorality. In other words, under normal circumstances, when a marriage ends and someone remarries, they are committing adultery. Now, very quickly there, the phrase adultery there is not so much referring to the actual sexual act that's taking place in the next marriage. It's referring to the entering into a relationship with somebody else, when in actual fact there's someone else who has legitimate right to you. So it's not even, you know, we haven't begun sleeping together or whatever. It's simply the fact that you have entered into this relationship that if someone else has the right to and the exclusive right to. And that's the reason why, whereas in our text, it says, and I said to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. In, I think it's Luke. Yeah, it is Luke. I just need to make sure. No, I think it's the Mark version, where he speaks about committing adultery against her, committing adultery against her. That's Mark. Let me quickly get to the actual text. Should be chapter 10. Yeah, chapter 10. And yes, thank you very much. Verse 11. I begin from verse 10. And in the house, the disciples asked him again about this matter, and he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another, listen to this, commits adultery against her. In other words, she is the one who has the exclusive right to the relationship that are now beginning with somebody else. And therefore, I am committing adultery against her. So it's not even beginning to talk about what's happening in the bed there. It's not even going that far. It is simply the fact that there is someone who has that exclusive right to me. And consequently, I shouldn't be giving it to somebody else. The Lord seems to provide only one exception. And we've seen it here. It is where your spouse was stubbornly continuing in sexual relations outside the marriage bond. It seems to be fairly clear that on that basis alone, he is saying, you are not committing adultery. Otherwise, the exception clause would not make sense at all. Okay, so that's one. The second situation where remarriage is permissible is where your spouse has died. Your spouse has died. And we find that in at least two passages. One is 1 Corinthians 7 and the other is Romans 7. So let's begin with Romans 7. Romans 7 and just the first three verses. The first three verses. Do you not know, brothers, for I'm speaking to those who know the law, that the law is binding on a person only as long as he lives? For a married woman is bound by law to her husband while he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. Accordingly, she will be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law, and if she marries another man, she is not an adulteress. So here's the second situation, and the bottom line there is the fact that your spouse or your former spouse, whatever the situation might be, the one who is entitled to that right has since passed on. This illustration would not make sense at all if it wasn't for the fact that you are therefore now entitled to remarriage. We find the same in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 39. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 39, which is right towards the end. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 39. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, and if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes. And then there's the addition, but only in the Lord. So that's a fairly clear second situation where that seems to be permissible. And in fact, it is stating it in no uncertain terms. Now, I do agree that there are a number of individuals who think that even in the case of stubborn sexual immorality, that you can divorce and then you shouldn't remarry. I know there are people who say that. The difficulty with that position is that, I want to repeat, it makes the exception clause meaningless. Let's use Matthew chapter 5 instead of chapter 19. And again, I want us to see that. Because what would the Lord then be saying if that's the case? So Matthew 5 now, and verse 31. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. We've cleared that. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, I'll just skip that exception part, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery, except on the ground of sexual immorality. Now, the point is obvious there. If you say that you cannot remarry, then the Lord might as well not have provided this exception clause. Because it means in every situation, you cannot remarry. But the Lord seems to be suggesting here that the person who is living in that perpetual sex outside the marriage bond, stubbornly doing so, is really forfeiting his own right. That's what he's doing. He's forfeiting his right. And therefore, when that other person now divorces him and proceeds to get married, there's no way the first guy can be saying, hey, that's my right. Well, if you knew it was your right, why were you sleeping around all over the place? So at least in those two situations, it seems to be fairly plain. The difficulty is when it comes to the third situation we talked about, and that is where there is the desertion on the part of an unbelieving spouse. The only way in which this can be argued is from silence. From silence. In other words, it's from the angle that if the person has been abandoned by the unbelieving spouse, and therefore the person is now free, as the Apostle Paul says, surely the person should be free to remarry rather than free and then the person cannot marry at all. But let's go to the text itself, which is 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And it's speaking about the unbeliever living, verse 15. The unbeliever living, verse 15. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved, is not hitched to that person. In other words, the person is now free. God has called you to peace. It doesn't say anything about whether that person remarries after that. As I said, it is an argument from silence. And those that would argue against it would be arguing on the basis that it doesn't say so. Those that would be arguing for remarriage would be saying, well, I mean, the innocent party is the one who has now been abandoned by the unbelieving spouse. Surely the person now should have opportunity to marry in the Lord so that now there is an actual Christian marriage. But I want to repeat, it's the weakest of the three situations. The first one on stubborn sexual sin, it's very clear from the words of the Lord. The second one, from the death of the spouse, is clear from the writings of the Apostle Paul. What about any other grounds? Divorce has already happened. What about that? Well, it seems from 1 Corinthians 7, verse 10 and verse 11, that the person should remain unmarried or be reconciled to the spouse. Let's read that from verse 10 and 11. This is now where you have been deserted by a believing spouse. By a believing spouse. Just an example there. Verse 10 and 11. To the married I give this charge. And this time it says, not I, but the Lord. In other words, it's in writing. It's there in scripture with the Lord. And it is this. The wife should not separate from her husband. In other words, no divorce. Period. Okay. What if it has already happened? He goes into it. Verse 11. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And then the husband should not divorce his wife, period. In other words, our responsibility when you have a situation of two believers parting is to try and get them together. Because both of them are seeking to walk with the Lord. And there may have been situations at that time, maybe lack of sanctification or whatever, that caused them to go their separate ways. But the Lord is continuing to deal with them wherever they are. And therefore, as church leaders, your role is to seek to help them to say, now look, how is your walk with the Lord? Well, it's better now. Well, there's this little issue that's still hanging in your life. Don't you think you really ought to deal with it? So that your walk with the Lord can be complete. Yes, but you know, the person did this, that, and the... Yeah, but we're also talking to him or her. In other words, on the other side. So that we are still seeking to reconcile real believers in the things of God. That's the way we ought to go. So it's not just, okay, they are not married anymore, so let's just look the other way and they should remain single. They should remain single. It's the fact that as we're ministering into their lives, because they both claim to be God's children, we are saying to them that, look, there's a place for forgiveness. There's a place to deal with what caused the hurt in the first place. There's a place for reconciliation. Let's seek to deal with this. Now, very quickly putting this together before we go into our question and answer session. You will notice that marriage, in terms of defining and everything, was clear. It was as crystal clear as anything could be. We came to divorce. It was clear in a number of areas. And then because you don't have so many passages dealing with the subject of divorce, we got to the point where we had to stop somewhere. And it was where the Bible stopped. The challenge is even more with respect to remarriage. We hardly have, in the whole of the 66 books of the Bible, we hardly have individuals who are divorcing and getting remarried. We have the head. And therefore, it becomes difficult to say, okay, so how was the church dealing with it, especially under the apostles? How were they dealing with it? And therefore, we can draw lessons from there. And that's what tends to leave gray areas. For instance, the difficulty here is that there are passages that seem to suggest that even after divorce, where there seems to be legitimate grounds, you cannot get married to someone until your spouse dies. And one obvious example that people rush to is Romans 7. Because Romans 7 there doesn't seem to be talking about, you know, okay, when there's adultery or, you know, sexual immorality, you can. It's simply saying, period, in one sentence. If your husband is still alive, you cannot remarry. Period. Now, exegetes would argue that the Apostle Paul was not thinking in terms of cases where there has been legitimate divorce. He's simply dealing with the fact that you're a married person, you cannot then go on to someone else. Your husband is still alive. But the point again I want to emphasize is that people can continue arguing in that text until the cows come home or until Jesus returns. Another one is also the Lord's use of the phrase commits adultery when divorce has already taken place. That surely should be food for thought. In other words, if we look at our text, Matthew 19, the Lord seems to suggest that people can be divorced and still getting into another relationship is committing adultery. In other words, it's possible to have the legal paper signed, given over. In our days, it's the law courts, they do it. And yet, in the mind of God, in the records of heaven, you are still considered as somebody who is in an exclusive relationship with the very person that you now have an actual bill of divorce with. Otherwise, the Lord would not be speaking in terms of you are causing that person to commit adultery when actually divorce has happened. So it seems that there is some food for thought that we need to process. That there can be situations where on earth we've got the papers, in heaven God is still saying that person is still the one entitled to this relationship with you, and is the only one entitled. So I'm simply saying there that these are the kind of gray areas that leave people having a lot of homework to still do. Another one is when it comes to Matthew 5. Many people come to Matthew 5 and see these examples of anger, lust, divorce, oaths, retaliation, and loving your enemies. And their view is something like this. When Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, and then he says, but I said to you, they view it this way, that Jesus is saying, this is what you were taught in the Old Testament. This is what you were taught by Moses. But now, a new dispensation is coming. And in this new dispensation, I'm changing the rules. After all, I am the lawgiver. And in this new dispensation, this is the way that we ought to behave. So, it was okay in the Old Testament to give somebody a bill of divorce. Verse 31. You have heard it was said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give us a figure of divorce. It was okay in the Old Testament. But now in the New, I'm changing the rules. And the new rules are that except for sexual immorality, any other situation, you are still committing adultery. Now, that's definitely, and I'm being deliberate there, the wrong interpretation of this part of the Bible. Jesus was not saying, this is the way it was in the Old Testament, this is now the way it should be in the New. He was not saying that. In fact, I'd like to challenge any of you who think so to try and find these statements in the Old Testament. Try. You won't find them there. For instance, anger. You have heard, verse 21, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. I'm saying, find it. In the old, use your concordance, or these days, Google, if you want. And also, here's another one. Okay, it doesn't say you have heard, so we can skip it. Let's go to verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Okay, that one might pass because it's definitely one that you can find. Listen to the divorce one. Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. I want to challenge you to find that. As I said, the closest would have been Deuteronomy 24. And Deuteronomy 24 does not say, let him give her a certificate of divorce. It assumes it's already happened. Oaths. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. I want to assure you, there's nothing like that in the entire Old Testament. Look for it if you want. Let's go on. You have heard that it was said, that's verse 38, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I want to assure you that that's not what you find in the Old Testament. Let me tell you what you find. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. Why have they skipped the life for a life? Because if someone kills you, you can't revenge. So this is a saying that was there among the people. And they are not including that because it's about revenge. And yet in the Old Testament, it's not about revenge. It's about the state punishing fairly. That's what it is in the Old Testament. One more, and I'm sure you will see. Verse 43. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Find me that verse. My next salary will be yours. Okay, so the point I'm making is this. Jesus was not pitting the Old Testament law with the new. He wasn't. What was he doing? He was pitting the teachings and practices of the Pharisees to what the law should have actually been teaching. How do I know that? Well, just before he started, look at verse 20. Look at verse 20. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. So what is the righteousness of the Pharisees and the scribes? Is what he now begins to tell us, giving us examples after examples. It is there. And that's why even the one about you shall not commit adultery, really their interpretation was physical adultery only. That's all they were thinking about. It was physical adultery. And Jesus is saying, no, actually, it begins in the heart. It begins in the heart. Again, another reason why to interpret that he's saying, the law, Old Testament now, forget it, it's now the new. Well, a little earlier, this is what he says, do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. He has just said it. So how do you then make him now again say, forget it. I've not come to abolish it. Forget it. Come on. All that Jesus is doing is removing the rubble of the Jewish leadership interpretations, the way in which they've managed to empty God's law of its real spirituality. He's removing that trouble and is making us see God's law in its spirituality. Why am I saying that? What it means then is even when we come to this, the one on divorce, it's not like Jesus is saying, okay, in the Old Testament you could give a certificate of divorce and send your wife away. Now you can't. No. All Jesus is now saying is, look, there's only one legitimate context where you can do it. And that is where there is sexual immorality. I think it's just important that we clarify that. Let me end, I've got a few more points here, but I really want us to wrap up so that we have a little more time on questions. So, there are answers that you can, there are answers to these difficulties that inevitably arise when you're dealing with the subject of remarriage. But one thing is sure, that God has never changed. God has never changed. And that's why Jesus said it was not so in the beginning. It's because it hasn't changed. And one way in which we can know that we are teaching as Jesus taught is if people's reactions are the reaction of the disciples to Jesus. Verse 10, back to our text. Verse 10. The disciples said to him, "If such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry. Then you know that it has sunk." When a person realizes that to go through this door, it locks behind you. When people realize that and they speak like this, then you say, then they've understood marriage as God intended it to be. And that's the reason why they said, gave this answer. It was when Jesus said that, look, except for sexual immorality, otherwise you are causing the other person to commit adultery, you are also committing adultery. And they thought, And of course, they began to think it's better to remain single. And Jesus was quick to say, singleness is not for everybody. Okay, that's what he means by eunuchs. Eunuchs were individuals that were serving the king or the king's household, and to make sure that, that those individuals don't end up giving you a prince who hasn't got your blood, they were castrated. And that's the reason why they were referred to as eunuchs. They were castrated. In other words, they couldn't have sex. So Jesus uses that picture and applies it here. It says, not everyone can receive this saying, but only to those who, to whom it is given. They are eunuchs, meaning individuals who are in that single state, who have been born like that. So from birth, they just never think about marriage. Secondly, and they are eunuchs who've been made eunuchs by men, such as the same, like the Ethiopian eunuch. And they are eunuchs who've made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. In other words, in their service of the Lord, they have seen that they are better off serving as single individuals rather than married individuals. And he's saying, let one who's able to receive this, receive it. Now let me try and help you. Single ones here. You are not gifted in that area. Married. Okay, don't start dreaming that you're a eunuch here. Marry! We don't want trouble afterwards. Okay, so as I close, let me put it this way. Remember what I said. The amount of material towards the end gets a little less difficult to put together. And that's the reason why it is always best that church leaders grapple with these issues. They should come to terms with having a position in the midst of the paucity of data, especially as we are getting further from divorce into remarriage. It's important that they still be able to say, okay, what's the safe ground? How can we stand here? And what it means, therefore, is that between different churches, there will be some nuances that will be different. Not everything, but some nuances that might be slightly different. And it's important for us to listen carefully and be able to say, okay, I can hear the argument there, as for instance, I just showed you in a few arguments, like Romans 7, for instance. But we still beg to differ. That this passage is, actually does not cancel out the exception clause. And the exception clause suggests that people can remarry without committing adultery in that sense. So you may agree to disagree, but you must agree to disagree as elderships. And when you agree to disagree, it doesn't mean you cannot have fellowship with them at all. You will respectfully disagree with their final position, simply because you recognize that in the scriptures here, yes, you could go one way or the other, and for us, I think the weight lies on this side rather than the other. And I think that's just important for us to agree on. In other words, for instance, you are listening, a number of you are from other churches, you've listened to me teaching here. You go to your own elders and start saying, no, but Pastor Bewe said, who is Pastor Bewe? You know, they are your elders. And if they have a position that's different from what Pastor Bewe has taught here, they are your elders. They're the ones you should therefore listen to and submit to. And we may still remain in fellowship with them, despite the fact that we have this difference in understanding. Okay, so I think that's where I would like to end. It will be the shortest, 42 minutes. All right, brethren, we are in the dying minutes. And there seem to be quite a few questions. Just unfold them for me, just unfold them. At least I have two to begin with. So we now come to the question and answer session. Please, if you need to leave, feel free. There's nothing to hold you. You can always sneak out. But if you still have time with us, we can go through. I do have some concluding remarks at the end of the Q&A so that we don't end with divorce and remarriage hanging in our heads. We should end with marriage hanging in our heads, which is what we're about here. Okay, so here's the first question. We learn from the scriptures that God holds a very high view of marriage. So how can a person who is single and would love to get married one day prepare adequately for it? I have three quick answers. The first is for you to get saved. In other words, repentance towards God, faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, for you to become a Christian. Because the biggest challenge that people have in marriage is the I, selfishness, which as an unbeliever is literally inevitable. That's all you've known. But when you get saved, what tends to happen is that Jesus becomes supreme in your life. It becomes what he wants rather than what you want. And so that's the first. Get saved. The second is walk with the Lord day by day. In other words, read your Bible and pray and seek to know the Lord so that you are learning from him and you are applying those lessons in your life. And what happens is that with the passing of years,
you undergo sanctification. You become a better person. And one of the ways in which you become a better person is in the marriage itself, when you are being rubbed the wrong way. But even before you get married, you are there for growing in grace. And then the third and last is basically serving the Lord actively. Finding a place in your local church where you are deliberately plugging in and serving the Lord. What that does for you, number one, is that it provides you a natural context in which you are likely to meet your future spouse. Because you will meet in the field, so to speak. You are serving the Lord, and you begin to realize that you've got common passions, you've got common desires, and so on. So it means that even when you get married, you are pulling in the same direction, because already your interests were in that direction. So serving Him. And also it means that at least you know where your interests are with one another, and you simply, as it were, hitch your carriages and you go that way. So those are the three answers. And you'll notice that none of them have got to do with, you know, read books about marriage and so on. Maybe that's what you may have been thinking. And none of them. It's get saved, walk with the Lord, and serve the Lord in your local church actively. The second one is, how many times can you forgive a cheating spouse? And are we always obligated to do so? Luke 17 puts it this way. Luke 17 and the first four verses. Luke 17, the first four verses. And he said to his disciples, temptations to sin are sure to come, but woe to the one through whom they come. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were cast into the sea than that he should cause one of these little ones to sin. Pay attention to yourselves. If your brother sins, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. And if he sins against you seven times in the day, and turns to you seven times saying, I repent, you must forgive him. If you've got a problem with that, talk about it with the Lord. Huh? But that's what the Lord is saying here. Now, I mean, surely it must be genuine repentance. In other words, if someone's going to flap you, pam, I'm sorry. And then just as you finish saying, okay, I forgive you, pam, I'm sorry. Then you begin to say, now, you know, you're not playing games here. Can you please be serious? Are you sorry or not? Because if you are sorry, you should not be continuing to slap me back. Okay, so there are issues that need to be processed there. There must be some way in which you are convinced that, yes, there's sorrow for sin here. It's suggesting that there is repentance. Here's another one. A man is unsaved and marries five wives. And so it so happens that he now becomes a believer. Should he divorce all the wives? Or the first wife becomes the only legally recognized wife? Now, the Bible's answer is quite clear. It is this: remain in the state in which you are when the Lord saves you. So let's go to 1 Corinthians 7. Bottom line is, you know, non-believers come with a lot of baggage. And to try and make them go back to try and unwind those truckloads of baggage, you probably will be working on a lot of extrapolations rather than what the Bible actually teaches. So in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 20, This is the abiding principle. You can begin earlier where he says in verse 17, only let each person live the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. He says, this is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the mark of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. For neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. And then verse 20. Each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a bond servant when called? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself the opportunity. For he who was called in the Lord as a bond servant is a free man of the Lord. Likewise, he who was free when called is a bond servant of Christ. And so forth. So, basically the principle there is, whichever situation salvation finds you in, you begin to simply work from that point onwards, rather than now turning around. And that's why, for instance, you don't find the Bible in any way suggesting that those who, when they get saved, are already in a polygamous relationship, marriage that is, that they then get rid of all the other wives and start saying, you know, the first one or the last one. Usually it's the last one they want to keep. The Bible simply says that such a person cannot be an elder. That's what it says. In other words, his marriage context is not an example for the rest of the church. And so forth. So, that's what we say, remain in the condition. Now, let me say, I know that most of these questions will be situational questions. And so, if any of, we do have a few elders in here for Kabata Baptist Church, if they do want to add an extra word, they probably will. Because situational questions are the most difficult to handle, as you can see. But I will give quick answers. First of all, is it right and wise to remarry immediately your spouse dies? First of all, I think it is right, but it may not be wise. Okay, because people are still emotionally processing you as the husband of that one. So though it is right in the sense that it's your right, you are free, I think you need to be a little more sensitive to the people around you. But again, you will never make everybody happy. Some people want you, first of all, to take 10 years before you remarry. So you, somewhere there's a give and take and so on. So the thing I would, in fact, let me say it up front because I'll probably keep repeating it here, is with respect to issues of marriage, divorce and remarriage, please seek the counsel of your elders. Before you marry, seek their counsel. If you are wrestling with issues and are thinking about divorce, don't simply go and announce that actually I've applied for divorce now. And so, no, no, no. Open with them. Be open with them while you are having these difficulties in your marriage, so that they are helping you as much as possible not to end up there. Similarly, your spouse has died or the marriage ended on because of sexual immorality, as we saw, and you're thinking about remarriage. Again, see your elders up front that, you know, I've begun thinking that maybe it's time for me to remarry. And, you know, there's that lady I'm now thinking about and so on. Let your elders help you. I think that's, I'll keep repeating this because there are a lot of situations and we can never exhaust the situations. There are as many as we are in this room. But within the context of a healthy eldership, they'll be able to walk with you through quite a bit of the details. Is it okay for a believer who has been abandoned to keep holding, waiting for a spouse who has already taken on a new spouse or remarried? I think we've already gone through this. What the Lord was teaching was that if your spouse has gone on to remarry, that's it. There's no coming back. It becomes an abomination. All right, so what are you there for sitting, hoping the other one will die? I don't know. Okay, so the Lord has already dealt with that as a direct one. Providence sometimes takes you to a wrong partner. What is it that you can learn in such a marriage? That God is sovereign. I know it's a bitter lesson, but it's a lesson nonetheless. Okay, that God is sovereign. If he did not want me to marry this person, he would have prevented it. Okay, he is sovereign, and let me glorify him even through this. What biblical principles can one use in determining right price? Okay, this is a little beyond our subject. Okay, seeing that it has now become commercialized. Yeah, this is a little beyond our subject. So let's move on to marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Experience has shown that when someone once upon a time active men and women means to get married, they quickly lose their zeal for ministry. How is this so, and how can it be corrected? Okay, without answering the direct question here, I think the bottom line of what I'd like to say is that marriage will either enhance your capacity for living for the Lord and ministry, or it will hold you back. It will be one or the other. It hardly ever leaves you exactly where you were. And if you find yourself being less and less available in Christian service in one way or the other, I think it's important for you to just check the foundation of your own marriage itself. Because remember, it is be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. Your spouse is an assistant, a helper suitable for you. The two of you should be able to do much more for the Lord. But also, there are phases in marriage. For instance, there's the phase when your kids are very small, and consequently they are demanding a lot more of your time. You have to be much more at home in the evenings and so on. So that means that you are cutting back on quite a bit of your external activities, especially those of you who don't have living mates, because then when you knock off, you have to take over the kind of activities that are happening there. So, but again, it's really your responsibility to analyze and say, you know, are we in a healthy situation as a married couple? Are we serving the Lord as faithfully as we possibly can in our context? And in that sense, I really would like to urge all of you, those of you who are married, to use your wedding anniversary to have a kind of retreat or end of year retreat. We'll just come away from all the activities, just the two of you, and you say, okay, how's been the last 1 year in these areas? And you look at them so that you are constantly getting better in the years ahead. So that aspect of review. So far, my fellow elders are not saying anything. Are customary marriages and marriage under the Act not blessed by the church valid marriages? Yes, they are. And if you were there in my first session, you will understand that that's what I said. Okay. Marriage is not a redemptive ordinance. It's a creation ordinance. It's the only reason why the church is involved is because we have the Bible and we have the definitions in the Bible. We are spreading the light from the Creator. Otherwise, it's a creation ordinance. And as long as two human beings are created, they have the urge within them to actually come together and marry. And God is the witness even there. And He will judge them about it on the judgment day, as one of the areas that He will judge them about, and so forth. So, the church blessing the marriage is a little superficial or superstitious. Actually, we don't, that's not what we do. We function on behalf of the state, actually. That's all we do. The state has recognized that the church can perform some of these responsibilities so that not everybody is rushing to them. And that's what we do. So at the end of the day, it's your faith and your obedience that actually produces a marriage that's a real joy out there. Otherwise, you can have your marriage here and, you know, people pray over you until the roof falls. You still end up in divorce outside. So we're simply playing a role on behalf of the state. Okay? So if for any reason your marriage is going to happen on Chulubi Island and there's no Baptist church or whichever church you're coming from, then please go marry and come with your wife. It is a marriage still. It doesn't mean it is any less a marriage. I believe when couples marry in church, they are accountable to God and church leadership. But what we see nowadays is that when they experience irreconcilable problems, they resort to go to court for divorce instead of seeking counsel. Why is this so? Well, I think we've covered that ground already. Please begin with your church leaders. Let them help you process a lot of these real difficulties. And sometimes it's not for a day or two. It might not even be for a week or 6 months. It may actually be a lot of work for years, because some of our deep-seated wrong habits take quite some time for sanctification to handle. And what you find is that they help you to take 3 steps, and in just one day you go back 10 steps. And you know, they start coming in with the fire brigade to come and put out the fires, and then again try and start all over again. So, go. I cannot emphasize this enough. Go to your church leaders. Let them help you. Now, the problem often is we hide. So when they come visiting and how's the marriage? Oh, very well, very well. Couldn't be better. You see, we give them Facebook type of impressions. And then they get shocked that, you know, the whole house is going up in flames. And then when they begin to inquire, they discover actually the whole thing had been rotting for a number of years. No, be open. Be open. Let them help you. That's why you have these leaders over you in the church. 1 Corinthians 7:15 suggests that an unbelieving husband, what about if the believing partner separates? Is he or she not enslaved? Is she free to remarry again? I think we saw that verse that spoke in terms of let them be reconciled, because that's what we do in the church. Our job in the church is to help individuals to come together. Now, there may be situations that as the elders perceive and weigh things, they begin to realize that, no, this is an exception to the rule. An obvious one might be where somebody is HIV positive, another one isn't. And so the person has sort of played out there, and then they now come back and say, you know, reconciliation. You know, the one who was keeping themselves, they're already seeing signs that, you know, this person is one leg gone. You know, you may have to think twice and three times. But that's why I keep saying, go to your elders, go to the elders, let them deal with these very real situations. Otherwise, the normal is when two Christians fail to get along and part ways. You have to help them to see that part of their Christian health is learning to get along. And if they are married, then the responsibility is even bigger. For someone to just say, no, man, I don't love her anymore. You are a Christian. God says, love your enemies. You know? So if she's your enemy, love her. You know? So part of your Christian growth will still lead you back together. All right, so... Okay, this is a good question, but it's in the wrong conference. What does KBC stand on complementarianism? Okay, next year, November, we will have our brother Gavin Peacock back, and we'll probably squeeze in something like this. So come around, whoever wrote this question, come around, we'll be dealing with that. How can you prove repentance if the offending party has done it more than once? Bring in your elders. You know, I keep saying this over and over again. Yes, I wouldn't blame you if you doubt. I also wouldn't blame you if you think this is not repentance. Because you are the one who's hurt in the situation. And because you are hurt, it's more difficult for you to process it. So, bring in your church leaders. Let them work with you. They will be in a better position to help you see whether what you have here is a weakness in which a person genuinely regrets, or a stubbornness where a person is being deceitful and just wanting to get away with it. You know, sometimes a person can say, I'm sorry, the way in which you throw a bone to a dog, isn't it? And it's barking at you, you know, it becomes quiet. So sometimes saying sorry can be like that. Hey, I'm sorry. That's not really being sorry. So again, it's a whole process. If there's one area where elders spend a lot of time, it's with marriages. That's where we spend a lot of time. And thankfully, we have a lot of successes. But once in a while, we throw up our arms. But don't stop us from ministering, because we have to. That's where you spend a lot more of your time. Okay, so can we regard pornography as a reasonable ground for divorce? The answer is no, because that's not what the Lord was talking about. He was talking about actual sexual immorality, people participating in sex outside the marriage context. Again, if you are the person who's struggling with pornography, or your spouse is struggling with pornography, don't hide it. You do have church leaders. Let them help you. Because, yes, pornography does hurt marriages. The women that, and it's usually a man's problem, the women that normally are on these pictures are idealistic, and therefore they tend to deprive you of appreciating the actual wife that you have in your marriage. And that hurts your marriage completely. So if your husband is having that problem, please don't try and keep it a secret. If you're struggling, bring in help. It will help your marriage. I want you to help me understand if there's a difference. In the church, men are allowed to bring ladies. And on the other hand, women are not. It's finished too quick. Or maybe it's, and women are not. In the church, men are allowed to bring ladies, and on the other hand, women are not. What I think this question is in terms of marrying across denominations. I think that's what it is. Yeah, that normally when a guy is importing a lady from somewhere else, everybody's smiling. But when it's a woman that is being about to be exported somewhere else, everybody's frowning. So could you comment? Really, the issue is not churches. The issue is beliefs. What they believe there and what we believe here. In other words, churches are by definition churches because of what they believe. That's why they are what they are. And so, if someone is going to come from another church, from another belief system to join yours, hey, they are welcome. But you are reluctant now to lose a member, to go and become a member in a church that's believing the very things you're trying to correct. So I think that's where the difficulty tends to be. So it's not so much simply churches, it is actual beliefs. And so elders do want their members to be in places where the belief is something that they are comfortable with. After all, they will be accounting to the Lord for this member that they are now releasing into that part of the world. And sometimes a lady can actually get married to somebody, a man elsewhere, but then insist that that person comes to that church. Or they may say, let's go to another neutral church, so to speak, and get our lives going there. I think these things tend to be quite open. Is divorce based on a spouse being mentally unwell, or especially where he's taking on an abusive nature? Again, the answer is no. The reason is quite simple. Please remember, marriage in its definition hasn't got an exit door. So if you occupy yourself all the time with, what about this issue? What about this issue? Come on. When you went in, the door locked behind you. And that's why the phrase, for better or for worse, is actually put there. So you may need to nurse a sick spouse for the next 15 to 20 years of your life. And all you say is, that's in God's sovereignty, the providence that has put before you. You don't say, oh, look, okay, I said worse, but not this worse. You know? I put in 5 years. I can't put anymore. I'm quitting. You can't do that. Men and women have done it, and they've scarred themselves for the rest of their lives, wherever they've gone. Because you had said to somebody that you love them unconditionally. And then they've had a stroke, and then you've abandoned them. How can you live with that? How? So, you will have to find ways to try and handle these situations. But to just say because, you know, the person has these mental issues, I'm running away, that doesn't help. Does emotional cheating amount to adultery? Again, that's not what the Lord has in mind. Okay, what the Lord had in mind was pretty straightforward. It was individuals who are in a marriage, but they don't respect the marriage bed. And so, the moment they see a skirt passing, they've gone off, and so on. You must see that this person is abrogating the very relationship, the covenant that they themselves are in. There will be a lot of gray areas in between, and let's not try and force them into the adultery clause. Otherwise, the hole will become too big. Okay. Again, if your spouse is, I don't know what emotional cheating is, but whatever you mean by that, please seek counsel. Seek counsel. You need to have a wonderful marriage, and you can have it. Lastly, and then if there will be any other questions, I can at least allow for 5 minutes. What if your spouse manipulates you? In the end, you are forced to consent, and the divorce is permitted. I think the answer is quite simple. If your spouse is a Christian, then our responsibility will be to try and reconcile you. So the guy may have been in a bad spiritual state, and they may have managed in that to manipulate you, whatever you mean by this, and so the divorce has taken place. Our task will be, brother, sister, this thing you got into has no exit door. So let's keep working at it, and see how we can resolve your issues. Okay. Is there any question that necessitates someone raising their hands? Oh. Okay. The last one here. Yeah, I'm being called by a title I normally don't get called by, but hey, once in a while it doesn't hurt. Prophet. Yeah, under sexual immorality as a cause for divorce, would we be right to add a situation where my partner's sexual orientation changes and they have a sex change from male to female or vice versa? The answer is no. I mean, first of all, let's assume that that person is a fellow Christian, and they begin to do such things. I mean, clearly they are opening themselves up to church discipline, because they are doing something sinful. And so we will be making a lot of effort to try and turn them around from doing what they are seeking to do. And that will become like one of the many other situations that I gave an example to in the marriage situations. So our job there will be to help that individual correct the wrong that they are allowing themselves into in their lives. This business of lesbian Christian and homosexual Christian and transgender Christian and so on, let's not get bogged down with the madness of the Western world. It's sinfulness that's causing people to do this. And we need to help individuals to correct those bad, sinful tendencies to come back into a healthy relationship with the Lord. If you want to know what your sex is and you're confused about it, just take off your clothes, I'll tell you. There's nothing complicated about it. Okay, the world is getting crazier, the Loser's Christ is coming back soon. But let's not follow it where it is going. These things are straightforward, okay? But thanks for the prophet title. Any other? Yes, right at the back there. Oh, the microphone is coming.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is
Alright, thank you very much. the question is, you know, that you're having quite a number of individuals who basically are discouraging the younger ones, who are showing love for each other, commitment to their marriage bond, are spending time together, and they're basically saying, we'll see, you know, it's because you've just begun, you know, you just wait. In the next few years, you'll also be like us. So what do we say about that? I think basically, my answer is that the church is always a mixture. You will never have a perfect church. You will always have people in the church who are backslidden. And therefore, despite whatever is good and lovely and full of truth, they spite it. They see you as being hypocritical and so on, because they judge you by themselves and they are in a backslidden state. And then you also have individuals who are walking with the Lord, they've got a healthy walk, and they would like to encourage you to do better. That's just the reality about the church. And so, you don't live your Christian life based on the opinions of people that are not themselves well spiritually. Base your Christian life by what the Bible tells you. And the Bible is telling you, as a husband, to love your wife as Christ loved the church, and you know you are failing. Because none of us has reached that level. So we have to keep on and on and on. That's really the path that we have. Similarly with our wives, to submit to their husbands as the church submits to Christ. Again, that's their responsibility that they ought to be seeking to strive after. And that's the basis on which we should seek to live our lives, and not based on opinions of people. Because I want to assure you, such people will always be there. Jesus gave the parable of the wheat and the weeds growing together. Do you remember that parable? That the owner wanted to start separating them. He said, no. Leave them together until they've matured. At the time of reaping, that's where we'll separate them. And that's just the case that If you are seeking to live for the Lord, there will be some people who admire you and encourage you. There will always be some people who are thinking, "Bale yufwa," you know, it's just boasting and so on. And one day. So we just have to learn that that's the world in which we are. Okay, so I hope we will see you younger ones continuing to show us what love looks like. Okay, yes. I think we'll make you the last, because I want to use the last few minutes to just close.
Right, you have some profit. Pastor Perry, you mentioned how the church
traditional aspect of it is you pay the mother, right? Right? And traditionally that's considered marriage. But in the church side, you still have to wait for the wedding ceremony, which in the first session is said to have added a great deal of importance to that aspect, whether the public. Now the question is, upon payment of bride price, can the church introduce the couple as married people?
Okay, that's a very good question. And that's a question that those of us who are Africans need to process. Remember, marriage is not a church ordinance. It's not like the Lord's Supper or baptism. We only have two, Lord's Supper and baptism. Full stop. Okay, marriage is a creation ordinance. A man leaves father and mother and cleaves his wife, and they become one. The church has come in because the state has partnered with the church. It basically said to the church, could you play this role for us? That's basically it. We should never think that there's some magic that we play when we say, I now declare the man and wife. The same thing is done at the civic center when the man is doing it there. He also says, I declare the man and wife. So the issue, nonetheless, is that the two of you who are getting married, you need to make up your minds as to what kind of marriage you are getting into. So, for instance, if yours is an actual traditional marriage, I use the example, you know, we've prepared you here, everything has been done, but both of your parents are in Chilubi Island. Fine. We've prepared you. Go. When you marry there, send us a text message. Hopefully you've taken a picture as well. We married. We'll announce here that actually our friends got married yesterday on Chilubi Island. Finish. You come back, we might have a small party for you, but you are married. So you make up your mind. Now, if what you want is a wedding that's going to be at a church premises like this in public, then yes, when you paid your lovola, wait for that event to happen. So you must make up your mind. Otherwise, the marriage is something that when you leave your father and mother and you cleave, it's a formal process. You are actually a married couple. So you can do it at the civic center, you can do it traditionally, you can do it through the church. What matters to us is that we've prepared. That's crucial. Because remember, after that day, and you go in, the door behind you locks. I tell you, it locks. So we want to prepare you for that, rather than give you the impression that unless Pastor Mbewe's signature is on that paper, you are not married. No, it's a creation ordinance. Okay. Good. Well, let's quickly wrap up. Now, the first thing I wanted to say in wrapping up is this, that wrongful divorce and remarriage are forgivable sins once they are repented of. Okay. So, we should not think that if you wrongly divorced and wrongly remarried, you are now in a sin that cannot be forgiven. There's only one sin that cannot be forgiven, and it is the sin against the Holy Spirit. However, and this is the warning, there are lifelong consequences. There are scars. So that doesn't mean because it's forgivable, let me quickly go in that direction. You end up paying for it. Okay? The second is you may have a different view as a person from the leadership of your church, especially when it comes to divorce and remarriage.
Please remember, you belong to a church. Whatever your church might be, there are a lot of denominations here today. You belong to a church. You need to ask your church's leadership, what is your view on this as a leadership? Because I'm wrestling with it. At the end of the day, it is your leadership's position there in your church that will matter. You cannot say, no, you know, Palwandi, Palwandi. You are a body together under a leadership. And therefore, what you might find is that, yes, your view may be a little more like the church over there, but remember, you must submit to the leadership in which you are. That's vital. Because once you go against the way your leadership understands marriage, the exception clause for divorce and remarriage, once you go against that, they'll discipline you. Now, once they excommunicate you, you can't then just jump to another church and say, yeah, no, at least you agree with you. No. They'll still say, go and sort out that issue back there. So, I want to plead with you that when it comes to those gray areas, thankfully, there are not many, as we have seen today. But once we get there and you have a slightly different view with your leadership, submit to your church's leadership on this matter. Thirdly, in a sense, I handled it when I was dealing with all this here. And it is this, that marriages rarely, if I've never seen it, go from a problem today, divorce court tomorrow. Usually, it's like a cancer which grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. The sin that finally leads to the divorce court is a sin that we allow to grow in our lives. My plea is, open up to your church leaders. Don't sit back and say, until they come to see me. No. The member says, Karipa. It's you who's in that crisis. It's you who's wrestling with this issue in your marriage. Call them in. Open up. Let them begin to help you now. Before, as the doctors will tell you, there's a point at which they say, now it's you can't operate it anymore. Okay, it's too late now. They'll just give you painkillers and then you die. You don't wait until then. Get help soon, and so forth. That's the third. And then the last. Is really to say that marriage is good. It's nice. It's the best gift on the planet. It's a slice of heaven on earth. Now, some of you are looking at me very suspiciously and wondering whether I'm married. But really, it is. But you see, it depends on us. That's where the catch is. It depends on us. If we play our role, then there's nothing like the marriage relationship on this side of heaven. Nothing. If we play our role. So brethren, trust me. It's the best thing that can happen to you. And if for any reason, that's not what's happening behind closed doors in your home, I'm saying don't settle for anything less. Seek help. Seek help. You can actually enjoy marriage and not just pretend about it on Facebook. It can be really real. That's why I wanted to end. on that positive note, so that we're not going away thinking divorce, remarried. Come back, marriage. It's a wonderful thing. Even if the door closes behind you, you don't start fighting to open it. You are happy it closed behind you, because you want to enjoy it in this life. Thank you very much. Amen. Thank you.